And Matthew LaCroix is back with us. He was back with me March of 2018, and his latest work is called The Stage of Time. Matthew also wrote the book, The Illusion of Us. We're going to talk about his work, which is fascinating. We'll take your calls next hour on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast, Matthew LaCroix with us, passionate writer, and researcher who grew up in the outdoors of northern New England. From a very early age, a strong connection back to nature was established and built into the morals of his life. His persistent yearning for adventure led him to profound, life-changing experiences that inspired him to write for local and national magazines as well. Again, his books include The Illusion of Us and The Stage of Time. Matthew LaCroix, back on Coast to Coast. Matthew, welcome back.
Hey, George. It's great to be here. I'm really excited for our discussion tonight.
And how have you been?
It's been great. It's been a really busy last couple of years since we last spoke. As you mentioned, I've been working really, really hard the last 3 years to release this latest book, The Stage of Time. And overall, I'm really, really proud of how it turned out. I'm a little bit tired because there's a lot of work, but I think the work was worth it.
It is worth it. And then after this program, you'll reap some of the rewards of your efforts, my friend.
Well, let's hope so.
Yeah, absolutely. I want as many people to read your work as possible. Tell us a little bit about the title, The Stage of Time.
Sure, George. So when I was finishing the last book I wrote, The Illusion of Us, I was looking through ancient history and the secrets of the past, and it became apparent to me that what we perceive as reality here is not quite what we've been told and what we've been shown to focus on, as in we think so much about physical reality and about how we exist here in physical form. But really, when a lot of the ancient texts say about the ancient cultures that came long before us, and a lot of the other groups later on that tried to protect and spread this knowledge, is they were talking about how consciousness is everything. It defines us as an eternal conscious energy beings, and that our physical body here is actually just a vessel to allow us to experience a physical reality here. And so based on that, I was very, very moved by some of Shakespeare's early quotes when he was talking about how all of the earth is a stage and how each of us play different roles here. And we're all essentially like actors playing on a great stage. And the more I thought about that and the more I read about it, the ancient teachings from the past and about how this is all just an illusion and a stage for us to experience a physical reality, the title just... It just sort of seemed to make sense, and it really fit in well with what I was trying to describe.
You know, as human beings, we have all kinds of ups and downs in life and everything else, yet it seems that if you can tap into this stage of time, you can really do things that are miraculous, can't you?
Yeah, if you can read these ancient stories from the past and the teachings they left behind, you can acquire higher states of consciousness and awareness that you would never be able to achieve otherwise. And when you do that, you, like you said, you go into this completely other side of reality that some think is, you know, a mixture of science fiction and just, you know, some hippie nonsense. But really, it's not like that. It's actually our entire purpose of being here is to explore reality and to grow on a conscious level and to reach higher stages of ourself in order to achieve the states of conscious awareness that we can to fully comprehend our existence here on this planet and in the universe.
And Matthew, why do you believe, and you included a lot of ancient texts and writings in your book, The Stage of Time, why do you believe that those ancient texts were so important and still are to us?
What we're finding now, and a lot of researchers are coming out to show, is that strong evidence from all across the world, from ice core samples to these ancient texts that were included, all the way to looking at these megalithic structures and the geology that we've seen that it's changed over time, the evidence really shows that we've had these disastrous cataclysms that occurred around the end of the last ice age, around 12,000 years ago. And when that occurred, it destroyed an entire civilization that used to exist. And a lot of people have called that the great lost civilization of our planet. And those civilizations that were here once, they left behind numerous ancient teachings and the wisdom that they had developed over thousands and thousands of years. And when they were destroyed, all that we have left are those writings and those ancient stories about, you know, what happened long ago, what their civilization was like, and who influenced their civilization. And so when I was going through doing research and putting this book together, it became apparent to me that I really needed to include as many ancient texts as possible, because in many ways, these ancient texts are being largely suppressed. And in other ways, they're also being destroyed and kept from society, because what they do is they tell a far different story than we've been told in school. They tell a far different story than we've been brought up with, which basically completely alters our perspective for both how far back human civilizations go and how sophisticated they were. And in many ways, the secrets that they knew about the Earth and the universe and the nature of reality is far superior than we have now. And so we, in many ways, after the disasters occurred, and I can go into that in great detail after, we had to start over as a civilization. And along the way, we've lost most of what we had acquired over time. And that's why I see the significance of these ancient writings. And so I've included what I believe to be more ancient writings and texts than any book written, because to me that's what matters the most, is preserving this ancient wisdom so it can exist long into the future for others to learn.
How did these ancients know what they knew? Who taught them?
That's the million-dollar question, and a lot of researchers have tried to put together certain ideas of how that could have been possible without trying to include outside influences. And there's a lot of varied ideas and ways that they may have done that. But in the end of the day, I really feel that the evidence is strong to show that these ancient civilizations were imparted this knowledge, okay? Because the reason I say that is not that I'm trying to downgrade human achievements. It's not that way at all.
Right.
I think humans have achieved great things here. But the reason I say that is that the Sumerians themselves specifically state in their cuneiform tablets, their writings from long ago, like we're talking about, they state, and of course, if you there's a little blip possibly in the history books talking about how the Sumerians were the first civilization on Earth who developed agriculture and mathematics and a knowledge of astronomy. But where did they get that from? Well, they clearly state in their writings that they were handed down this wisdom from above, from what they called heaven. And of course, that term later became referenced and used in a lot of biblical ways. But heaven essentially meant beyond the realm of Earth. And these civilizations became, you could even call them, obsessed with those entities and those beings that they were in contact with and they were getting influenced by, and they became the ancient gods of history. And they became the angels and the demons and all the things that we think of in a more biblical reference. But what it comes down to is human beings exist in a third-dimensional physical reality, but there are at least science and string theory and looking at metaphysical nature of our reality shows that everything is based on vibrational frequency and that there are at least 9 different dimensions. So when we consider that, and that us here in this physical dimension is only giving us a small glimpse of what actually represents reality, it wouldn't be that far-fetched to think that there's a lot more that exists beyond what we can perceive, and that those civilizations and cultures could have been influenced long ago from many, many different places, and that we simply have become very close-minded of accepting the fact that, you know, we live on a planet that's surrounded by vast cosmos that has, you know, almost infinite Earth-like worlds and potential for life to exist, and yet we keep a very close-minded viewpoint of anything that could have influenced us in the past, and we always think, oh, these achievements are ours, everything is all about humanity, you know, we've gotten here because of our own right, and we can do whatever we want because of it. But really, I don't see that the way it is at all, and I see us more as stewards here, and we should really be changing our perspective based on this information from the past.
How does human consciousness play a part of this?
Human consciousness plays a huge part in this, because it's basically what this great stage is all about. If we think of us as eternal conscious beings, and that's what defines us, and the body is more like an antenna, in a vessel for us to experience a physical reality, then altering one's consciousness was the only way for someone back then, or even now, to be able to experience these other sides of reality, and also to potentially get into contact with any beings or entities that may exist in these higher and lower dimensions. And I think that's why you see a lot of both strange rituals with some of these elites we've seen in the past, with things places like the Bohemian Grove and a lot of these strange sacrificial things for lower vibrational dimensional energies. But really, then there's another side of it where there have been other sacred ancient priests and a lot of these wisdom mystics and wisdom bringers who have worshipped higher dimensions and have tried to use consciousness to alter, to connect to some of these higher dimensions. So it seems that altering one's consciousness to move outside of the third dimension is what the great focus has been of a lot of these civilizations. And some have used it for good, and some have used it for bad. But it seems that consciousness really is the great purpose of this stage here.
Matthew, let's go through some of these ancient writings and texts, and you can explain what they mean and how they're so important to us today. The Book of Enoch.
Sure. The Book of Enoch is one of these, you could call it a pre-Christian writing that was left out of what we think of as later Christianity and the New Testament and how Christianity was later reformed after the Holy Roman Empire. But the Book of Enoch is one of these pre-Christian ancient Gnostic writings that talks about how a lot of this ideas of consciousness and the nature of reality that is not included in the Bible. But one of the things that's remarkable about it and why it's not included is that it talks about these watchers that are here that they consider who observe our reality and observe humanity from afar, and that instead of us thinking that we're all alone here, we're actually being observed the entire time, and that the Book of Enoch really goes into explaining how things in the past were a lot different than they are now. Things, even in the past, things like giants used to exist, and how human beings are part of a great cycle of consciousness that changes over time, and that we're reaching what is known now, according to the Mayans, as universal consciousness, when we will no longer exist in what was called the old reality, the old paradigm that used to hold us back through the means of materialism and a more of a Darwinian perspective.
Interesting. Now, how about the Atrahasis?
So the Atrahasis, so I included all of these ancient translations in my book, and I actually have...
How did you find all these, too, by the way?
Well, that's why I included them, because when I was going through this, a lot of this information is online, unfortunately, and I say unfortunately because when you go online and you're trying to find it, you could be flooded by disinformation by almost every side,
right, exactly.
Or someone could just very easily come out as being a credible academic, and it could say, well, everything you just read in that translation is a mistranslation. And then the person would then be all confused and think, well, it really seemed to make sense when I was reading. Oh, well, okay, so it's all just a myth, and it's all just some parable and some metaphor. It's not real, right? Well, when you go and look and you actually study these, you find out that there have been very credible people who have translated them. And what I do is I go back to the source of the greatest experts that have translated them. In my opinion, those experts go all the way back to the 1849 to George Smith with the Chaldea account of Genesis. And George Smith, and so we're talking well over 100 years ago, and George Smith was basically an Assyriologist expert. And he translated these texts long before we had any of the stigma we have now, where people think, oh, Zechariah Sitchin mistranslated everything in these texts, and the Anunnaki aren't real, and none of this is real. Well, just go look at the Chaldea account of Genesis, written in 1849. George Smith translates the Atrahasis in that, and he clearly states and backs up that of course, first of all, that the Anunnaki are real, and that they've played a major role in our past, And that's what the Sumerians called them. They called them the Anunnaki, but they themselves, these ancient beings that we called gods, called themselves the great Anunna. And the Atrahasis goes through an account of talking. What's so important about it is it's basically one of the accounts that discusses pre-cataclysm disaster of the last ice age. So when we think, well, what records do we have left to try to understand what happened with these ancient civilizations before they were destroyed? Well, the Atrahasis is one of the most important of all of them, because Atrahasis himself was considered the last king of the city of Shurupak. And Shurupak was a city in Mesopotamia which was later destroyed as part of this disaster. And according to another tablet, the Sumerian King List, which is how you verify this information, you find out, his name in the Sumerian King List was Zayasudra, and he was known as the son of Ubaratutu, who was actually a great king of Shurupak. And then the story just keeps weaving deeper and deeper, and you continue to research this character who wrote these tablets, and you find out that he later became the biblical Noah that later on survived these disasters. And that's the only reason he was able to write down the events of what happened, because he was one of the few elder priest, great kings who was able to actually survive this event.
These texts are almost all like little Bibles, aren't they?
Yeah, they're written such an ingenious way. They're not only written in a way where we can understand the events of the past and the mentalities that they held then, but they're written in a way where they can provide stories that have important meanings and important ways, parables, for us to essentially relate back to how we perceive reality and how we perceive duality and everything in the universe. Those stories are written in such a creative way where they encompass those essential stories of that make up essentially our moral character and how we define ourselves. But they also give us this glimpse of what these civilizations were like and what happened to them and then what they left behind.
Interesting. Now, here's one, the Code of the Hammurabi.
Yeah, that's an amazing one. That's actually one that few have ever heard of.
Where did that originate, by the way?
The Code of Hammurabi is considered the largest cuneiform tablet in the world. And unlike clay tablets that are usually much smaller and have been written on and then baked, the Code of Hammurabi is this enormous stela. And what it represents is, in Mesopotamia, there was an ancient city called Babylon. And I know a lot of people have heard of Babylon.
Yes.
Now, Babylon itself is another one of these cities that spans a much longer time period than we've been taught. And the way that works is essentially it's been rebuilt over time after these disasters occurred. And the Code of Hammurabi is discussing how when a lot of these kingships were being established, these models for civilization, after these disasters occurred and before, they would lower kingship with all these moral laws and codes for how civilization should go. Now, Hammurabi was became one of the great kings of Babylon, and he left behind this great stela called the Code of Hammurabi. And according to him, it was this stela that he created based on all the moral laws and codes that he had been given directly.
Hold on for that second, Matthew. We'll come right back after the break with the Code of Hammurabi, and there's so many more next. And welcome back, Matthew LaCroix with us. His latest book is called The Stage of Time. And Matthew, we're talking about the Code of the Hammurabi. And at the time, Babylon was the empire of the planet, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. During this time period, during about 1712 BC, Babylon rose to become one of the largest city centers in the world. It had over 200,000 people. And one of the interesting things about that is, well, how did Babylon rise to become such a large center of civilization? Is that just a random coincidence? Well, it's actually not. We were discussing the Code of Hammurabi, and according to the Code of Hammurabi, which I was talking about before, it's essentially a 7.5-foot-tall stela with cuneiform writing all the way down it, and it describes 282 laws to follow for bringing stability and morality to mankind. Now, Hammurabi clearly states that he did not create these laws himself. And that's what is so fascinating about this information. You see this over and over again. You also see it with the legend of Atanya, too, how these kings are essentially given kingship and rulership over a certain region, and then they're given certain moral laws and codes for how to rule over civilization. So it's not like these kings just end up there and then they decide on how the kingdom is going to be run. It seems more like they're emissaries, and they're chosen to rule. And that's one of the reasons why the Anunna are called the ordainers of destinies. That's what they actually say about themselves, because they create what the destiny would be. So what Hammurabi says, and when he's in this stela, he discusses where all this came from, and he shows how this being he calls Bel, B-E-L, and he also refers to the solar deity aspect of it called Shamash. But he says that this being presented him with all of this information and knowledge and then told him essentially how to rule. And I'm just going to read a really quick quote of how this large stela code starts. It says, "When Anu, the sublime king of the Anunnaki, and Bel, the lord of heaven and earth, who decreed the fate of the land assigned to Marduk, the overruling son of Ea, god of righteousness, dominion over earthly man, that made him great among the Ijiji. They called Babylon by his illustrious name, made it great on earth, and founded an everlasting kingdom in it, whose foundations are laid so solidly that those of heaven and earth. Then Anu and Bel called by name me, Hammurabi, the exalted prince, who feared God, to bring about the rule of righteousness in the land, to destroy the wicked and evildoers, so that the strong should not harm the weak, so that I should rule over the people like Shamash and enlighten the land, to further the well-being of mankind." And then it ends by saying, "When Marduk sent me to rule over men, to give the protection of right to the land, I did right and brought about the well-being of the oppressed." So you get this information that talks about how, well, wait a minute. So he is given this rulership from Bel, who you find out is just simply another name for Marduk. And then this story just keeps weaving deeper and deeper. Well, okay, so the city of Babylon itself is actually a name that is translated directly from the name of Marduk. And then you do a little digging into Marduk, and you find out that Marduk was literally the chief god of Babylon.
What happened to Babylon, and when it was so strong, Matthew?
Babylon became corrupted by a lot of different things. One of those things becoming a war empire. And there's actually even some areas that talk about how some of the kings of Babylon later were starting to dabble into things like black magic and some things that are...
I mean, it overlapped into Iran, Persia. It overran into modern-day Israel. It was all over the place.
Yeah, it's actually really amazing that you find out that Babylon, like I was saying, was ruled by this god known as Marduk, whereas just north of Babylon, the city of Nineveh was a city who was ruled over by Enlil, who was known as Ashur. Now, you find out that both of these gods hated each other, and they were in fierce competition. And just like that, you find out that Nineveh in Babylon had been competing for supremacy over the Assyrian Empire for years and years and years. And they were two completely different places. Babylon started as a place of accumulating wealth of knowledge, but later became corrupted by military might and empire building, whereas Nineveh was more of a place that was establishing physical beauty. Nineveh was actually the location of the famous Hanging Gardens, because it was connected to the first aqueduct ever built on Earth in the town of Jerwan, Iraq. Now, that aqueduct fed this was connected to this incredibly lavish city called Nineveh, which is the location of where this king named Ashurbanipal formed this massive library that few have ever even heard of, called the Royal Ashurbanipal Library. Now, Ashurbanipal was a high priest who realized the importance of these ancient texts, just like Hammurabi did. And so while Hammurabi and a lot of these other kings are gathering this information as well in these libraries, so was Ashurbanipal. And so the Ashurbanipal Library that he created ended up being probably the most significant library ever created in human history. it was actually suppressed even, it was actually even exceeding the Library of Alexandria, because it contained ancient writings from far earlier than that ever had, which we know the Library of Alexandria was later burned down by the Romans when they invaded. So the same thing happened in Nineveh. Eventually, Ashurbanipal died, and so Babylon joined forces with the Chaldean people, and they overthrew and attacked Nineveh, and they burned the entire city to the ground, along with this library known as the Royal Ashurbanipal Library. Well, hundreds and hundreds of years later, thousands of years later, in 1849, they found those ruins when they were doing an archaeological dig. And thankfully, because cuneiform tablets, that people don't know, they're basically clay that has writing etched in it that that's then baked. It's a very ingenious
method. Are they rolled up as well?
Some of them are rolled up. You have something called like a cylinder seal, and you have also something called a cuneiform tablet. And they're both different ways, these ingenious ways where they could preserve either depictions or certain information. And so the Ashurbanipal Library was essentially this amass of thousands of cuneiform tablets that had been collected, and a lot of those were later housed in the British Museum. But the thing that's amazing about it, and this is the reason why I wrote this book and why I included so many of these translations, is most of those ancient cuneiform tablets. And remember, this is the wisdom from these lost civilizations that we've been made to believe don't even exist, and yet they provide this knowledge of an entire time period that we think is just a myth. But the thing that's important about that is that those translations in those ancient texts, most of them are still untranslated. They're just sitting there.
Tell us about the Emerald Tablets, Matthew.
Okay. Well, if you want to go back even further...
How far back do you go, by the way?
I go back well over 12,000 years.
Wow. Okay.
Well, that's you know that because... You have ice core data from Greenland that specifically discusses how this time period of the last ice age, which was around 12,000 years ago, dramatically ended. And when it ended, it killed off all kinds of megafauna that used to exist in the northern hemisphere.
This is almost Atlantis time period, isn't it?
Yeah. And that ice cap is called the Laurentide Ice Sheet, and that covered the entire northern hemisphere of the planet. And that was in the time period... When that melted, that time period was called the Younger Dryas. And when that melted, it destroyed entire lost civilizations that were existing on the Earth. And now, one of those lost civilizations that is talked very extensively about from the Egyptians, which was later translated and given to men like Socrates and eventually Plato, was talking about the existence of Atlantis long ago, somewhere southwest of the Straits of Gibraltar, which is in Western Africa. And Plato talks about in the Timaeus and Critias extensively how this grand civilization was destroyed 11,600 years ago or in that time period from violent cataclysms that wiped them all out. But what you find out is that Egypt, which at that time period was called Khem, which is before the dynastic pharaohs, we have to really alter our entire perspective of these different time periods of history. When this civilization called Atlantis was being destroyed, the people there, some of these priests, moved to Egypt, and they attempted to establish a new civilization there.
What destroyed Atlantis?
That's where the Emerald Tablets were essentially created. What'd you say, George?
What do you think destroyed Atlantis? Then we'll get to the Emerald Tablets.
Okay.
Did they destroy themselves, or was there some calamity?
It was a two-part thing. According to these ancient writings, Atlantis was first corrupted morally. They became a civilization that became corrupted by wealth and corrupted by power, just in a very similar way, actually, to how our society is going today. But
I was just going to say that.
I know. And so later, what they talk about is, as Atlantis was being destroyed, and it wasn't just a one-night thing, they talk about how there was a lot of volcanic activity and rising sea level, and so Atlantis was being slowly destroyed. It wasn't just an overnight thing. And because of that, some of the priests and these wise individuals left Atlantis to found a new civilization. But Atlantis was later destroyed, just as the civilizations that were later created in Egypt were. that's a very important thing to wrap our heads around, because the dynastic pharaohs who wrote all the hieroglyphs that came later, they had nothing to do with the Great Pyramids or any of those large structures that are there. Those are remnants of these ancient civilizations that were there long ago. Just because hieroglyphs exist on something does not mean they created it. A lot of these empires and dynastic pharaohs, when they found these structures, they wanted to take them over as their own so they could rewrite history and become great leaders. And so you asked about what destroyed these civilizations. Well, the evidence that's now coming to light, and I talked about, again, looking at ice core data and looking at geologic evidence and looking at these ancient tablets and seeing everything that goes together. And then the final piece of the puzzle is, when you identify where these megalithic building practices have been done around the world, you go to places like Machu Picchu, you go to places like Pumapunku, and then you go across the world in places around the Mediterranean and through Baalbek, Lebanon, and Petra, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, right down into Mesopotamia and Iraq with places like Kinnis Rock, in all of those locations, and of course down into Egypt, in all of those locations, you find this advanced, sophisticated building technique with these megalithic structures. Megalithic means large single stone, okay? And those structures have been carbon dated, especially in locations like Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, to be over 11,600 years old. So you already get dating that proves that they were around as part of these lost civilizations. But then the question becomes, well, what destroyed them? And that's where you start looking at what I was mentioning with all that data. When you go and visit these buildings, these structures, especially in places like Karnak, Egypt, and around the temple, the enclosure of the Sphinx, you find that when you can establish, okay, I know that this lower section, this precision building right here, this is from the old civilization, and then later on top was then built over by the civilizations that came later, much less sophistication, much more primitive tools used, sort of backwards of our thinking. But what you find on those structures when you can identify them is that they've been, in many ways, destroyed, thrown and strewn all over the place, but also they've had something called vitrification occur to them. This scarring you see on them, this breakdown of the rock, this burning that's occurred on the surface, turning some of the quartz that's contained within them into glass. And you also find that desert glass in parts of the Sahara. So what could have created that massive amount of heat to destroy some of these structures and cause these civilizations to be destroyed? Well, the great theory that is really being proposed that starts to make sense is that it seems that our Earth goes through these cycles of destruction based on these sun changes, these solar changes. And what happens is over time, the electromagnetic protective grid that exists around our Earth is weakened over these certain periods of time, and it can allow these dangerous solar outbursts to come into the Earth, and those can have dramatic effects far beyond just the solar implications. They can cause pole shifts. They can cause dramatic earthquake seismic activity in volcanoes. They can create things like tsunamis and very
yeah, and in our case, they're going to knock out the power grid.
Yeah, and that's, of course, where this is all leading to is, are we going into one of those cycles again? Is that why they're doing things like secret spraying to try to reflect these incoming solar particles, or to reflect the incoming solar radiation with these highly reflected particles? Is that why that all this stuff is going on? Is this part of these secrets that we're, here we go, human civilization has yet again, as part of another epic, risen up again to reach a more sophisticated level, and are we, just like our predecessors in the past, are we about to be wiped out and reset as well?
I remember when I first read about the book of Genesis, how it just fascinated me, and I spent so much time, Matthew, trying to interpret the somewhat parables that were written in there. Did you find that the case too?
Yeah, I did, and I found it fascinating too. Actually, I went backwards. I wasn't a very religious person, so I really didn't read a lot about directly through Genesis at first. I actually went the other way. I was reading the cuneiform tablets at first, which were some of the information in these cuneiform tablets predates what we think of as some of this information that's in Genesis. So the reason why that was an interesting way to go about it was that when I went from the older information first to Genesis, I was then able to really relate what Genesis was saying, talking about how they were giants in those days, and about how, you know, even all the way to human origins, saying that mankind was created in their image, you know, the image of the gods. And it said God had, you know, gods plural rather than God. And it started to bring up all these questions. But it really starts to connect when you read those, and then you go back to these cuneiform tablets and these ancient stories that were left behind. They really paint a picture to show, oh, wow, that's where a lot of this came from. And that's where a lot of the pure forms of these can be found still.
You're a believer in intelligent life in the universe, aren't you?
I am. I think really, if you, one of the things I break down in the book so extensively is if you really, really sit down and you break down things like the Drake equation, the Fermi paradox, and you start looking at, okay, here we have a vast universe. Even our galaxy alone that we exist in is one of millions to potentially billions of other galaxies that are in the known universe. And within just our galaxy alone, we know that there are potentially millions of Earth-like worlds. And the way you know that is very simple. The Drake equation was named after this ingenious person named Frank Drake.
Yeah, that's where SETI was built from.
Yeah, and it comes down to this idea of, okay, all you have to do is figure out what complex life forms need to survive.
Hold on, Matthew, we're at the break. We'll come back for more and calls next.